Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. So today we're going to talk about the movie Alien vs. Predator Requiem, with an interview with the brothers Strauss, Greg and Colin Strauss, who directed the movie and did all the visual effects at their facility, Hydraulics, which we'll disclaim right now is where I work. On the line with me is John Montgomery, who did the interview, since it would be weird for me to interview.
Awkward. Hey, Jeff, how are you going? Happy New Year, my friend.
Yeah, same to you. Thanks very much. Good holidays.
Oh, yeah, it's been fantastic, getting a little R&R time out here in the Rocky Mountains. And I think it's always important to take a little time off, if possible, around the holidays to kind of re-energize creatively, you know. It's like, it can be a tough grind for us VFX artists.
That's for sure, yep. Yep, I'm off in the Midwest myself and having some good family time, and it's been nice, although I'm not used to this weather. I'm too used to LA now. I know.
Well, hey, before we get into the interview with the brothers, which was actually a lot of fun, I had a fun time speaking with them, I just want to give a little bit of tease about our new term at FXPhD, which is opening up in January. I've got to say we're really excited about it. We're going to have full details at fxphd.com beginning on January 1st, and registration for the term will actually open at that point as well. But we've got a great lineup of courses yet again. If I do say so myself.
Oh, absolutely. Last term was amazing. If it's even remotely close to last term, I'm still catching up because there's so much content. But, boy, the photography class, I've just loved the flame class. Background fundamentals alone is worth the price of admission. I got to tell you, the background fundamentals, Mike's just been doing an amazing job on those.
I think so. He's done an incredible number of episodes on that too, coming up with new content and new information effectively every week of the year. I mean, he's doing a 30-minute program.
Yeah.
Every year. But, you know, you mentioned the photography course, and we'll tease some of these courses. And again, full details are on fxphd.com. But we're going to build upon the production courses and do a second digital photography course, which I think is really great. It's going to be concerning digital photography for VFX. The course last term, or in the October term, which, by the way, is also being shown again. We're having this course in January 08 term. But the new photography course is going to be covering VFX related stuff, things like HDR, shooting elements for composites and so forth. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and again, building upon that first course, which got a fantastic response on the site.
Yeah, it's been great class. I've been loving it.
In addition to that, from a production standpoint, we're going to be continuing on with a second RED course, and for this one, we're going to treat a little bit differently, and it's going to be production-based, going to do a short project and follow that project all the way through the pipeline from prepping to getting the imagery out of the RED and into, you know, Final Cut and Assimilate and all the other applications you need to work with. So it's going to be much more practical from the standpoint of, you know, let's do a project with RED and show you how it's done. So we're also going to be rerunning the RED course that we did this term, which is just an overall introduction to it, with some updates, because you know that the RED is really a moving target in the way things are changing on a weekly basis when new software comes out.
Yeah, I think I saw an email on Christmas Day or the day after about new firmware already. So, I mean, the camera just keeps moving software-wise, development-wise. I think they're replacing some parts on the cameras for the early people.
Yeah, definitely doing a little bit of all that. And it's really great the way that they're listening to input from people like us who've been involved in beta. It reminds me of the early days of Discrete, you know, when you have a smaller company that's really targeted on making the end users happy. So it's been definitely a learning process and learning the workflow with RED, and we're still learning. But yeah, the company's been incredibly responsive about that.
Right. Now, I understand we're also doing more of a kind of a, if you want to call it a design track, kind of like our production track last term, a little bit of a...
Yeah, something we've been working on and wanting to do for a while. It's probably been our number one request from the members at FXPhD is doing more design-based stuff, and I think this term we've delivered on that. We're going to be taking a look at Motion from Final Cut Studio, the new Motion, or you know, semi-new now, I guess. But the key on that is our professor for that is actually going to be Damian Allen, who quite literally wrote the book on Motion. And so we're really excited to have him involved, because if anyone everyone knows that app. It's certainly Damien. He's incredibly knowledgeable. Obviously, he's done some stuff with Shake as well. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun having him involved in FXPHD. It's something, like I said, we've been working on for several terms, getting involved in, and happy that he's agreed to do the course. Top of that, of course, After Effects is, you know, the de facto leading standard in, you know, design and animation, I think, for anything, you know, for everything from broadcast to commercials to film. And we've kind of approached it from, you know, a compositing standpoint in the past. We'll continue that. We'll have a course with Mark Christensen, who covers After Effects for compositors. It's a repeat of a course. We've got a brand new, really heavy-duty, hardcore design based course with Tim Chapman from the UK, and he's going to be taking a look at he's going to be breaking down some projects that he actually did on the job, which I think is going to be a lot of fun. Where, you know, we've made a real effort to be able to distribute footage and so forth with all the courses, but in this case what we're going to do is we're actually going to take a look at several real world jobs that he did and take a look at how he executed and got them from, you know, concept to on the air. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. And finally, on top of that, we have a typography course, an introduction to typography. That's being taught by Frank Jonan, who's really great, has actually designed several fonts, actually in conjunction with Herman Zapf, actually, in designing a font. And he's going to be covering everything from type terminology to how do you kern and layout to really hardcore stuff like designing your own font in, say, Fontbook on the Mac and PC, and how you design it differently or modify that font based upon where you're using it, whether you're using it in print, whether you're using it on screen, whether you're using it in a program like Nuke, which actually has a different requirement, and how you'd create that font and, you know, deal with the hinting of the font. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. It's shaping up, again, to be a great term at PhD. And, you know, Mike and I and you are just having a blast doing this thing. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been a great experience, and the terms just keep getting better. And like I said earlier, if this term's anything like last term, it'll just be amazing, because I got such a kick out of last term, and I learned a lot. You know, I love that. I love that you can sit down for a half hour and just learn new stuff about your craft, and even in areas you may not, you know, like I don't have a red camera, but I've been enjoying the classes because I want to know the issues if workflow comes up my way in the future.
Yeah, and you're going to, I'm sure, you know, and everyone's going to be start running into, I know people have actually run into getting red footage in-house at post-production facilities, and man, it's here, it's coming, and you're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and it's not always the most straightforward thing, so
exactly.
they're doing a good job of getting better at it, but again. So, you know, why don't we talk a little bit about the podcast this week now. You're based at Hydraulics. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about Hydraulics and the kind of work that's done there?
Sure. The brothers Strauss are the founders of Hydraulics. I've been there for about 3 years, coming up on 3 years. Seoul, Chicago, Seoul Design Effects, a division of Cutter, shut down their LA office 3 years ago. And after a brief visit to New York with my friends at Charlex, I came back to LA and started up at Hydraulics, and had no idea what I was in for and no idea who these people were, what they were doing. I'd heard good things, but I had no idea. I walked in, and 3 years later, here I am. The brothers have directed their first feature film, Aliens vs. Predator Requiem, which opened on Christmas Day. Did about $9.5 million that first day, which early reports, you know, I think this, by the time the 4 or 5 day weekend's over, it should be a pretty decent box office. I haven't really read too much detail about that other than that first day.
Right. It's interesting, too, the movie, and talking with, I love the idea, number one, about it coming out on Christmas Day, isn't it? You know, this hairy score, you know, scary horror film where actually, you know, a little kid dies in like the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, I don't want to get into any. I saw the movie, I you know, I will say, that's a perfect setup for the movie. It just keeps rolling from there.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it online, if you haven't seen the first, I think it's 5 to 10 minutes online, it's available for viewing. It's kind of a hoot to watch. But
I mean, the thing that people have to remember with this movie is it's not, and the brothers talk about this in the podcast, it's not $100 million movie. It's not, you know, a gangbuster budget movie. This is a little movie. It's and that's what they really tried to focus on, is keeping it action-packed and moving, and, you know, really pay. There was a lot of criticism over the first AVP, Alien versus Predator, by the diehard fans. And the brothers are diehard fans of this franchise, of this genre, and you know they really wanted to pay proper respect to that and give the fans something, but also make a movie that's fun to go see. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the movie a lot. It's not really my thing necessarily, but I loved it. And
yeah, that is the important thing. Yeah, it's in a lot of ways. Again, they talk about their effects budgets. It's not a fair comparison overall to talk about it in the scope of things in comparison to the original Aliens, for instance, by any stretch. But I think that's one of the interesting aspects of our conversation. I was interested to find out, you know, how them, the directors being involved in a post-production company, really helped them budget-wise throughout the process. And we actually talk a little bit about that in our online article about how much your facility is worth. This idea of this, you know, having a little bit of your hands in the content as a post-production facility. And I think that's pretty interesting, Jeff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, at the cast and crew screening, I thought it was fascinating. The guys from ADI were there, and they kind of spoke before the movie played and said, you know, they were a little nervous going into this, knowing that the directors owned a visual effects company, thinking, oh my God, they're going to take and try to do all this stuff CG. And the brothers are smart enough to know that, you know, A, they didn't have the budget for that, and B, you know, they wanted this thing dark, gritty, rainy. They wanted it scary. And, you know, that's doing CG characters in the rain would be a very expensive proposition if they even could. You know, so there was a lot of stuff in that movie that I hadn't seen, because I haven't seen the cut until we saw the preview, the cast and crew. And there was just a lot of shots in there that I'd never seen with the creatures, because they were all suit and they looked great. And, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They addressed this definitely in the podcast, and how they didn't want to do everything CGI because of their knowledge of the post-production process.
Right. Well, it's really funny for me, the brothers, when I was working in Chicago years ago at Editel, we're talking 15 years ago, maybe 18. Editel was pretty much the leader in town at that time, and we had a fairly qualified, you know, we had a good CG department, and we lost a job to two kids in their garage for a CG job. And I was like, you know, everybody was freaking out about it, and I was like, look, get used to this. You know, if you don't want to do this, you better build the best CG department you can have and be prepared for that to happen again and again. If that, you know, you've got to be able to compete on different levels if you want to do that. Otherwise, smile and move forward, you know? Well, it turned out those two kids in their garage were the brothers Strauss.
Yeah.
So I didn't even realize that until after I had moved on to Hydraulics and kind of put two and two together and realized that's who they were. They were the kids from Waukegan who had done
And they built a CG department that basically two guys in a garage can't duplicate.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. You know, I don't know how many people Hydraulics has grown to, but I know during the peak of... I mean, we were doing AVP, we were doing other projects, as the brothers talk about in the podcast. And, you know, I bet we were over 150 people, maybe, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Total. I mean, it was... You know, we did 450 shots for AVP. You know, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's a very impressive facility, the brothers have really done a great job of getting a really solid workflow in place for feature films there, and the way that they can handle large jobs and do it, you know, really effectively and quickly, I think.
What's really funny is nobody, I mean, I got an email from somebody saying, you know, I understand that Hydraulics uses a lot of shake and I'd like to get in there. Would you recommend whatever? And I just was kind of taken aback, because I think it's been fairly well known that Hydraulics is a little unique in that we have nothing compositing wise in terms of the main compositing tools than Flame and Inferno, which is very unusual these days, but there's probably 20, 25 workstations on an average day in there, depending on how many we own, probably 20, and then there's rentals all the time. And a 36-node burn farm, and it's all... Basically, it's an Autodesk show house. I mean, you've got Maya, all of the roto and stuff is done in combustion, and all the compositing is done in Flame and Inferno and Flint. And we have, you know, shakes there for glue, for making dailies, and the CG department uses it for test comps and things like that, but... In terms of anything that goes out to film or for commercials, it's all done with that pipeline.
Yeah, and that's really fairly unusual today, I'd say, for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not uncommon that you have several Flame or Inferno workstations inside a larger facility, but to do the kind of commitment that there is at Hydraulics to do it exclusively on those systems is really interesting.
Yeah, it is. But we crank out shots. I mean, we're a very busy facility, and everybody's very hardworking. It's actually hysterical to me, because there's, when I mentioned that Seoul shut down the LA office, there's actually four former Seoul people working with me at Hydraulics. MB, who I worked with out here, a lot of people in the flame community know her. She was one of the first, you know, few flame operators in the country, in the world. Had one of the first flames in the U.S. in Chicago, on the old hardware. And anyway, we worked together at Seoul, and she's been there with me for a while now. And then Laura and Greg Sowers, Laura Sevilla and Greg Sowers are both from the Chicago office, just happened to move out to L.A. and were doing freelance and ended up at Hydraulics, and they've been there for a while. In fact, Laura was one of the compositing supervisors on AVP Requiem, so it's kind of fun.
The family reunion.
It is. It is.
Those are all great guys. The opportunity to meet and, you know, would like to work with them, but you know, Chicago's a good, friendly production community.
Oh, yeah.
Not too competitive between the various post houses.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think we had to listen to the interview. The brothers, I think it was a good interview. I really enjoyed it. And let's hear what they have to say about the movie Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
Well, thanks for that, Jeff. And thanks, Colin and Greg, for joining us today.
Hey, how you doing? Great to be with you guys. Yeah.
Now, Alien came out in 79, man. That's almost 30 years ago, and I'm surprised that my parents let me see that film, actually. But it really did set the standard, I think, in my feeling, for this horror genre and even sci-fi horror genre. Do you guys remember seeing your first Alien film and being influenced by it?
Yeah, I mean, actually, Colin and I saw Aliens first.
Okay.
And we were watching in a pay-per-view in a hotel room in Rosemont, Illinois. Our parents were actually at a kind of a craft convention show, so we it scared the living hell out of us when we first saw that. So never forget the first time we watched that movie.
Now, I think when we sat down, I think right before you went and actually filming the film, we were out in Santa Monica, and we remember talking about kind of being true story wise and true everything wise to the fan base. Do you feel he's kind of succeeded in that now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really important when approaching a film like this that, you know, you really consider the sort of, you know, canon of the previous movies. A lot of that went into the design of the creatures. You know, we went back to Jim Cameron's ridged head design for the Warrior. The predators one predator is vastly retooled since the last film. You know, completely different sort of physical appearance, much thinner, much more athletic, a lot less armor. So, you know, just in terms of strictly the way they look, there's a lot of consideration and also a lot of the behavioral stuff. The Predator, we really went back to the way Kevin Peter Hall performed in the original Predator in 87. The kind of tribal, ritualistic, kind of African hunter sort of mannerisms and nuances to his movements. So, it's definitely, a lot of thought went into that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and actually in each of the Aliens film, the alien takes on, you know, some aspect of the host creature, of course. And in the opening minutes, obviously we see it's the Predator that's host. How did that impact the design and behavior of the alien?
Well, the overall guiding principle was, you know, we still wanted to, you know, anything that comes out of the DNA of an alien should still be overwhelmingly alien. So we're thinking, you know, it's more like an 80-20 or 85-15 split. Therefore, you know, the tail is very alien-like on our Pred Alien. The overall exoskeleton feel is primarily still there. We then stole things from the Predator DNA. The mandibles were an obvious choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the color scheme was very Predator-ish, and we wanted, going on the idea that Predator DNA might be a little more dominant than human DNA. Our Pred Alien stands more upright than an average alien. It's bigger, taller, more powerful. And we also went with incorporated Predator dreadlocks, although they are designed in a sort of skeletal fashion of an alien tail. They look like little sort of, little links of bone, like mm-hmm. the exoskeleton kind of look. And what else do we... Well, a little bit of musculature in the feet from a Predator were incorporated in the Pred Alien, but those are subtler design cues.
Now, the creative aspects and the design aspects of the character, how did that influence discussion of CGI versus practical as far as the Pred Alien?
Well, Oh, go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea was to always try to do as much practically. I mean, we knew the cloak predators were going to be CG, and, you know, we decided that, you know, and it's also a financial thing, too. I mean, once you build the suits, they're kind of free on set.
Yeah, and this is a smaller budget movie. I mean, we have less money than the last movie. We're making a small horror film here. It's not a $100 million summer event film. You know, under $40 million small town horror film. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre was sort of the approach taken. So, in that regard, you know, and a lot of money is being spent on building the suit. So everything we could do with a guy in a suit, in some ways, you know, that was free. That was really cost effective once those are made. So, and also the atmospheric considerations. So the back half of the movie is all at night in the rain. So anytime, you know, you can actually have a guy in a suit there with the real rain hitting him, it just, you know, looks all that much better and more real. So that was in camera was definitely the guiding philosophy. And anytime, now with the creatures, though, there's a lot of limitations. Now, you get a stunt head that you can punch and hit, but then the jaw doesn't move or the lips don't quiver. Or if you have the full actor in the suit with the animatronic head, you can't physically, they can't fit the inner jaw striker in. So if you want to do all that in one shot, you need to get into a hybrid. And the tails are very difficult to puppeteer in a convincing fashion. So a lot of times you have a hybrid of a guy in a suit with an animatronic head, but a CG tail and a CG mouth striker. And in some cases, we had to go with a full animatronic puppet, which was a full torso, fully animatronic arms, torso, head, and everything. That was mainly for the Pred Alien, for the scenes where she's impregnating the embryos into pregnant women in the hospital. And that's because the reproductive mechanisms of the mandibles was a big mechanized assembly, and you couldn't have an actor inside the suit for that, so that the whole animatronic puppet was needed just for that sequence.
So, and the creature, the practical creatures were actually done with ADI, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, now, the release of the film, of course, over the holidays, I gotta say, it's not the holiday family flick, but, you know what?
We look at it as counter-programming. Yeah.
Hooray for the R rating, let me just tell you. How freeing was that, actually, for you, and I think a brilliant decision to get back to the original spirit?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the original pitch. I mean, one of the reasons I think Colin and I got the film was we went in, I saw what they were going for, we totally, bought into the idea that, like, this should be a horror film again. The last film was much more of a sci-fi sort of adventure flick. We wanted to go small, gritty, horrific, visceral. You know, it was like, take Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but instead of a guy with a chainsaw running around, we'll have aliens killing people. So that was very much the essence of it.
Yeah, and these films, especially going with that R-rating, their films have historically been just very dark in nature. How did that kind of approach the design and lighting design and so forth for the movie?
Well, Carl and I were trying to figure out who our cinematographer was going to be, and I had actually worked with Daniel Pearl on a couple of music videos in the past, and luckily he was available, so we're like, what could be better than getting the guy who shot the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Right. And actually, you know, we were a huge fan of Marcus Nispel's remake he did in 2004. I just thought the look of the film was fantastic. So we got, you know, getting Daniel Pearl to shoot it really, you know, Daniel Pearl is all about backlighting, edge lighting, cross lighting. It just creates a great gritty feel. I think the film has a fantastic look.
Yeah, you can see that from what's available online and in the theater. Now, how true did you have to be, or did you want to be to the original Alien, the Predators, for that matter? Do you feel limited by that, or did you kind of just look at this film on its own?
Well, it is a standalone film. Obviously we don't want to go and try to change any rules that were established in those originals. So, that being said, it is a different kind of film. We are on Earth. It's the first time we are in a small town setting with these things running around. We never wanted to have an alien and a predator fight in front of a McDonald's or anything like that. We did try to pick a lot of locations that were reminiscent of Alien or Aliens. We have sewer scenes, some big sets we built that you know, could be something out of Aliens. There's a power plant sequence that you know has a bit of the field of metal grate work and everything's, you know, and we've incorporated steam jets in that as much as we could, kind of make it feel like the end sequence in Aliens. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of the movie takes place in the forest, and we got a very spooky looking forest that we found that where all the trees are really overgrown with moss. Trying to make this feel as dense as the jungle did in Predator. So, you know, there were things we wanted to make sure we tried to live up to the originals as good as we could within the budget and time that we had.
Right. Now, an interesting aspect of this, let's move on to post, but you guys are obviously well experienced in post-production and effects, and that had to help you a ton during production. I mean, did you do heavy previs? I mean, what are the things going into shooting that you think helped?
Yeah, I mean, we previs as much as we could. Basically, you know, we had about 12 weeks of prep, which was pretty quick, and the script was getting rewritten for that. So we tried to prep as much as we could without actually having the finished script in hand. Any of the action sequences, the stuff in space in the beginning, you know, a lot of that stuff we prevised extensively. Everything that we didn't previs, we boarded. We boarded every dialogue scene. We boarded everything out. So we had a huge binder. So, you know, in terms of what we were actually going to shoot, that was well prepped out. But, because we had to go through and design this. Before you could previs stuff, we had to design the sets. And some of that we had to do before we even had a production designer on board.
Right.
So we actually had our workroom with our artist team at Hydraulics. We were designing and laying out sequences and giving set sketches to the production designer once he was brought on. And, you know, we had to stick to all that because otherwise if he changed anything, it would invalidate all the previs work that was being done. And then while we were up on set, actually had Josh Cortez, it was one of our animation supervisors here, and he was overseeing and actually doing a lot of the previs in our trailer on set. So, if 1 week while we're shooting one thing and during lunch we'd go in our trailer and review previs with Josh for what we were shooting the next week, because we weren't able to get everything done ahead of time. Sometimes, you know, we're just able to keep a week ahead. So, but, you know, that's always useful. It's better than going into something not having any previs.
Well, it's actually interesting. And now I know it's not free, of course, when you're using your in-house crew to do stuff, but it's got to give you an advantage to have what I'd say flexibility, right, in scheduling and relying on in-house talent in that process.
Yeah, and having a guy like Josh there, I mean, he's so hardcore. He's prevising 80, 90 hours a week. And, you know, and editing, cutting the sequences himself and, you know, putting everything together. While we also had PLF doing previs down here in Santa Monica or in Venice, and they were handing over their stuff to our editor who was then assembling scenes. You know, we had to have multiple teams in parallel just because there were so many sequences that, you know, and you get through, you do a sequence and you want to make a bunch of changes and improvements to it. So you never want to go and shoot the very first pass of the previs. You want to get that thing tweaked up and tuned up as well as you can.
Yeah, definitely. And given your strengths in compositing in 2D and 3D that you have there in-house, do you think you approached the film differently on a set? I mean, did you shoot less reference? Were you interested in having more actual reference and see it in camera?
It depended. We did, and it's not we didn't shoot enough reference, but there were a lot of situations where we didn't waste time shooting plates that we knew never get used.
Right.
So, you know, we've definitely seen a bit of that historically. You're like, oh, my God, they shot 7 passes for this shot? I mean, that must have taken half the morning. We just didn't have that kind of time. We were under incredible time pressure because we had a much bigger script and bigger, loftier ideas than our 52 days of shooting that we were budgeted for would allow. So we had to be very efficient and really move through stuff quick. So, you know, the good thing about knowing – you know, we would not just have the technical sort of background, but we also have the practical, like, oh, God, they shot all those things. We never use that stuff anyway. So we never kind of bogged ourselves down with that shit. It was always about, you know, we know we need to have this in order to do this right, so we're going to make the time for that. But the rest of these things, forget about it. We'll just brush it under the rug and move on. Any place where there's a trade-off of, doing something exactly by the book or at the risk of losing scope, we always chose to keep the scope.
Right, yeah.
And we didn't want to do anything that was going to make the movie any smaller.
Yeah, and being at the receiving end, I'm sure on other films in the end, obviously took a lot of experience and were able to apply that on set for sure.
I mean, look, we've kind of been witness to tens and tens of millions of dollars and just wasted money on stuff that either was ill-advised or didn't ever work out or didn't end up in the movie in the end. And, you know, so always using that kind of background and historical knowledge is pretty helpful.
Now, an interesting aspect about post, actually, I feel, is that you actually did the editing in HD there actually in-house, right?
And so, yeah, we did everything. Fox was great and let us set everything up in-house here. So editorial was here. We talked to Fox early on in prep about wanting to use Final Cut HD. They had used it in limited, but with great success, in limited fashion on 300. And it seemed like it was very stable, and the guys over there in the visual effects department were thrilled about Final Cut HD. So we got got a bunch of systems. Fox bought into it, set up the assistant stations and our main editing station here, and did everything at 1920 by 1080, which was just fantastic. We did all the dailies were transferred right directly to HDCam SR for archival purposes and to Final Cut Media. So we would get a hard drive every day with our dailies and a Final Cut project, and we'd just watch our dailies in Final Cut. It was awesome because you could just, jump to the next take and look at stuff. It was just such a slickly organized way of doing dailies, but it was still at almost full 2K. 1920 is pretty damn close. And the compression is very negligible. So from a qualitative standpoint, we could know if we blew focus on a take. We knew if something was smoky, and when the dailies colorist brought it down, it got really grainy. We knew there was, we could see a lot of the technical problems. Whereas if you're just doing dailies off DVD, you miss most of that shit, and then you discover all your problems in the DI.
Yep, yeah.
So that was very, very helpful, having everything in Final Cut. It was such a slick system. If we were off in some remote location, we could still look at our dailies in 2K on our laptop.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It was great. It was really fantastic workflow. And I can't believe how many huge, huge movies that will work at the same time as us or start up after us are still cutting stuff in standard def on an Avid. And then here's one of the most amazing things about the whole process was that when we did our director's screening, we do any sort of audience test screening, we don't have to do an assembly.
Right.
It's like we did all the visual effects. By the way, all the test comps for visual effects had to be done at 2K, or else they looked soft compared to the dailies.
Wow. Exactly. So, Colin, how did that actually help for the VFX standpoint in having all that in-house and seeing it so early, like the previs?
Well, it was great because it's Greg still, by the way, but for some reason, Colin's just sitting there on the phone not saying anything. But, we were just able to, artists were able to walk up to the editor and say, oh, I got a new shot, drop it in, and let's just take a look at it. And you don't have to wait half a day for an isolated editorial department that, and those guys can get really grumpy when they're off on their own little island and all they worry about is their own things and they don't have any consideration for any of the other trials and tribulations of the production process. The animators could walk in and say, I got new, does this thing work? It could interface directly with the editor, and everyone was all part of the same team instead of these isolated departments that kind of bicker with each other. So that was very helpful. And the editor could walk down, sometimes Dan Zimmer would walk down to the animators and go, can we just change this thing? We need this just to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great. And then Colin and I, we could walk across the hallway from the edit bay over to the Infernos and make comments on test comps and then walk back in and still work on editing. So convenience factor for us was awesome.
Now, from a workflow standpoint, let's talk a little bit more specifically about your CGI. What kind of 3D apps are you using there? I know you've got...
There was, Maya obviously is the foundation of everything done here.
And then Mental Ray for all of our rendering.
Okay.
Then RealFlow for particle sims and some Stroika stuff for some particles. And then a lot of Biflex for any sort of cloth or, you know.
Yeah, like that. I don't think there's a whole lot of cloth in our film.
Well, we use it for some, like, drool and ripping guts and stuff like that. But
yeah, but a lot of the blood splats and gore is done in real flow. You know, the mental rape pipeline is plugged into our proprietary, huge in-house base of proprietary shaders. Important part of that pipeline is all the final rendering is done to log color space.
Mm-hmm.
And then those log renders are then taken into the infernos, and all the compositing is done in log. And then the really interesting part of the finishing pipeline was not only was editorial in-house, but we had 2K assemblies of the movie in our smoke system. So all visual effects reviews are done in smoke at full 2K with sound, which was just is like the ultimate visual effects review workstation. It's probably the most expensive visual effects review workstation, but it's better than being in an inferno and doing it. We have all the same color correction tools in that as the inferno, but the editing, the editing speed and flexibility, just working in 2K, the smoke pushes around like nothing. It's so fast. We would make lots of editorial changes in the smoke, and then using our in-house asset management and database system, it actually tracked all the edit changes, and we would then report those back to our editor, to the editorial staff, and they'd make the little trims and cuts and adjustments.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, the smoke was. All the smoke review sessions are done on our new DI suite, which has a 22-foot screen and a Barco DP90 2K digital cinema projector.
Wow.
So everything was looked at, and basically in a DI, high precision color calibrated environment.
Now, we talked to you right at the end, I think, of 300, and we talked a little about the review and approval process, and I think I know where your answer will be on this, but are you guys more of a looking at the scene as a whole or stopping on the frame and zooming in and looking
well,
at it?
Well, it depends on what part of where we're at on stuff. I mean, obviously, there is no more critical environment these days than looking at something on a 20-foot-plus screen with a 2K digital cinema projector. If it looks good there, it's going to look good everywhere. It is the most critical way of looking at stuff, and although it costs more now because we're having to catch every little mistake, it is making the work better. And it's only going to look better when it goes to film.
Right.
Because film's going to usually hide anything that you'd see in such a stable environment. It's also way better. The stuff I hate, I still don't like, is so many of our clients reviewing stuff that is super compressed QuickTime.
That's pretty crazy, isn't it? I think.
It's like they make comments about blurry this or sharp that, and the compression algorithms blur some things and sharpen other things. So, we're not crazy about that, and they're generally not looking at QuickTimes dropped in a cut either.
Right.
Our in-house daily system, if an animator wants to look at a QuickTime of a shot, it automatically can drop it into the cut, so he's only looking at it in context. And, a lot of the productions, they don't have the ability of doing any of that. These are all in-house tools we've created that are, really help everyone just focus on what's actually in the movie and not have their opinion corrupted by stuff that's in handles. And, it's like we don't make compositing decisions on QuickTimes here. I don't like that.
Yeah,
I'm still completely against that. We all
that's a bizarre work.
Animation. We talk about animation on QuickTimes. Fine,
because you're looking at broad strokes and movement, and
yeah,
and
it better be
detail.
And it better be in context of the cut.
Yes,
but anything compositing wise, 2K log uncompressed is the only way we do any sort of compositing review here whatsoever.
Now you have in the compositing and log space, you have a huge number of discrete systems. So you were rendering out, were you doing multiple passes out of CGI into the Inferno?
Yep. Oh yeah. And one of the new things that really enhanced the workflow, so we're running with Sapphire 4, and one of the great things that Todd and Carl over at GenArts did for us was they added in the a light 3D spark.
Isn't that cool? Yes.
And that thing is off the The two things that they really improved, there's a Z depth of field, and, which, you know, we used in every goddamn shot.
I'm so with you on that.
and then the light 3D, so that now it's the standard procedure, you know. And I mean, other shops have implemented this a few years ago, but the, you know, getting this into the Inferno pipeline and having Sapphire write the spark was a huge help, because now normal passes are a standard rendered pass, and then in the Inferno we'd add more spec or add another key light if we wanted to, and it's great to be able to do a little bit of lighting work in the Inferno based off the normals. So that was definitely a productivity enhancer for sure.
Now, some of the newer, I guess the newer versions of Inferno have some of the, at least you can store half-float images on the FrameStorm. You can kind of see where the maybe movement's going in the future on those products. But do you not find the bit depth limitations a crutch or anything in post for you guys?
Right now, if you're doing work in 12-bit log, like color banding is... That amount of precision has not been a problem for us. I'd say that the bigger limitation, and then once we start, you know, one of the things that we've been talking from a pipeline standpoint with, you know, our in-house team here, is we get start getting into half float and start examining that workflow, and to start, then we start changing. We probably don't have to do work in log anymore.
Right.
Because then we can start working and just stay true linear. But, yeah, there's management issues with that in terms of, you know, having to manage exactly what your white point is and what your black point is. So, in some ways it's six or half a dozen on some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But, whether you work in, you know, if you work in log, the problem is certain things don't necessarily work in an intuitive fashion.
Right,
and you're trying to deal with stuff like comping clouds with a lot of transparency in that, or dust elements. Trying to do stuff in log with that, it's a little hard. It's a lot harder. Once you know how to do it, you know, like you get used to it and you can get good at it. But just straight out the box, you get some artist who's never done it before, it can be kind of daunting. Whereas in linear, it's very intuitive doing those kind of operations. So. Hopefully that half float thing will change our, you know, we are planning. We haven't implemented that version yet. We always like to stay a few months behind just because there's always stability concerns. So it's going to be very interesting to see as Autodesk starts building more and more of that, how that helps.
Exactly. Once you start building more compositing tools for that. But the key is you've built a really solid log workflow that works for you. And my guess is a large part of that, you have I don't know how many machines you're up to, but you have what I'll call a ginormous burn render farm.
The burn render farm is at 36 nodes, and we've started upgrading some of those machines to 8-proc, you know, the quad dual-core boxes.
Oh, that's got to be crazy.
Which is really just amazingly fast for running the compositing on. There were, all summer long, I mean, we ran 20, there's been 20 systems here, so... Between Flame, Flint, and Infernos, so it's one of the bigger discrete places around town.
Yeah, and that really extends versus a bunch of different, and of course you can have shake render farms and so forth. But that really I found in working, especially with high res material, the burn render farms really can increase the throughput and the kind of work that you're getting through the facility.
Well, yeah, I mean the biggest thing is like why we're such like Flame and Inferno fans is, you know, desktop editing in real time at 2K.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, all right, trim two frames, hit play at 2K. Okay, trim another frame. All right, insert a frame here. You know, there's still no other system that can move around that kind of data that fast and efficiently and deal with, you know, there's the inherent editing abilities in these boxes is so important for visual effects work. So, you know, and the fact that every box has 4 or 8 terabytes of, you know, really fast disk. Pretty standard now for the average compositing machine here to have 800 megabytes a second of disk I/O.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that's just like standard now.
Yeah, the crazy.
You just take it for granted.
you build a reputation on that kind of workflow and getting the job done really well from a creative standpoint and also from a time standpoint as well.
So yeah, and you need that because I mean we did 450 shots on AVPR. We did 160 or so on Invasion at the same time, 250 on Fan 4-2, 140 or so on Shooter. These are all these, you know, from January of 07 to November of 07 when we finished AVP2. I mean, there was probably close to 1,000, over 1,000 shots done on, and most of them have lots of CG in them. It wasn't like 1,000 wire removals. These were a lot of big shots, so...
Yeah, it really, really tells in what you can get done. In closing out here, I think one thing, we'll look at it two ways. This having all this post-production and editing in-house, you're directing it. Do you feel there's a certain danger in being too close to something? I mean, how did you manage that from your perspective of being so intimately involved from the shoot through post, just potentially clouding your judgment and what works and what doesn't?
So, I mean, I think that's true on anything. Like, I mean, even any visual effects job we're doing or that, I mean, when you're working on something really long, I mean, that's just, you know, that's just kind of a skill that you have to develop of taking a step back. And I think the fact that there's two of us allows that, where, you know, sometimes I'd be a little bit more involved in the editing on something, so then Greg could kind of come in with fresh eyes and look at it and go like, okay, that works, or this doesn't work. And then vice versa. So, I mean, I think the advantage of having two people definitely helps balance that out a bit. You know, because you need those sort of checks and balances to kind of keep everything sorted.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the hardest thing happens when you watch your cut too many times. Because you become numb to it. And then, like, sometimes, you know, we'd work on little individual scenes and tweak the hell out of them, but not watch the movie for 2 weeks and then watch it.
Right.
Yeah, just to give yourself a break from it, because there's nothing better than, like, walking away. I mean, generally, like, with visual effects work, you know, there's always stuff I'm not happy about, and I'll walk away for 2 weeks. Or you finish the movie, and then you see it a month later, and you're always much happier with it because when you get so close in it, you actually become hypercritical usually, and you start nitpicking and hating things that are so tiny that the audience never, the average members would never even notice, and you end up disappointed in it, but overall the shot looks good. So usually with visual effects work, I'm much happier after not looking at it for a while. The cut's different though. The cut, by not looking at it for a while, you can become more objective.
Mm-hmm.
And be, you know, make better self-critical judgments. You watch the thing every day, you know, at a certain point you become numb and it gets harder to tell what's good and what's bad.
With all the resources in-house, was it difficult to kind of keep from continually massaging things? I mean, it's probably a little, since you own the means of production, it's a little easier to
change. Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a tendency to want to keep, like, trimming, you know, as the visual effects get closer and closer to being done, you start want making little trim edits. We're so pitcher heavy here, where we kind of think pitcher drives everything and everyone else should be made to suffer, but the sound guys need time to do their job right. So if you keep tweaking shit a frame here, a frame there, all the way to the end, you start screwing the sound guys. But most post schedules are built in that there's enough time in the mix. And, you know, the mixing environment these days, you have so many Pro Tool stations on the mixing stage, and you can actually cut new sound effects on the mixing stage so quickly. I shouldn't be telling the whole visual effects community this, but the mixing, the technology and sound design and sound editing and sound mixing is, you know, it's kept up with the amount of advancements in visual effects, for sure. So...
Changing sound effects within the cut is one thing. Changing the length of shots, though, once you've already, once you're in your finals, that gets kind of nasty, though.
Yes.
Well, your bigger problem is actually music.
Yeah, music is
sound,
the bigger.
Sound effects move around isn't as bad, but once music's been scored, trying to take three frames out of the orchestra, that doesn't really work.
No, not going to happen.
No. So if you take three here, you better add three there. But, you know, once you're, you know, into the last couple weeks and you're in the scoring stage, like, that's it. So, you know, there's little things they can do, but you're pretty locked in once music's recorded. So
we talked a little bit about the pitfalls, but I think in talking to you, just gathering from our conversation here today, that, you know, owning the means of post-production and so forth could actually... I mean, do you think that could be a trend moving forward? Because you talk about the budget on this film, and you need to be very smart about the way that you do things. And it seems like you're able to bring that knowledge to the whole project.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, there's a lot less waste when we're cutting in the same place where the effects are being done. Like, I think the one nice thing is we're never able, the effects are never able to allowed to go the wrong, down the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies. We'll go down, we'll turn left at an intersection, and then after 4 months, someone says, no, you should have turned right there. And we're like, you could have told us that 5 months ago, guys. Are you fucking serious? Like, you're really telling us this now after we spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars doing this? It's not like we haven't been showing you. So that kind of thing, that was a nice efficiency that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff would never went backwards.
Yeah.
So, and that allowed us to, cut costs a little bit here and there. And we needed to because, it was not an enormous budgeted film. Our budget of our entire feature is less than the effects budget on a big summer blockbuster.
Right. So it's especially critical that you approached production and post the way you did, I think.
Yep.
To end up with the film.
Absolutely vital.
Well, it's a really nice addition to the, as you said, the holiday slate of films that's out there. I think it's going to get a great response in the theaters. So again, and thank you for taking the time to speak
cool.
with us.
Cool. It's great talking to you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, John. And thanks to the brothers for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, that was a really enjoy talking to them. And again, as we talked going into the interview, I find it quite interesting that they're built the entire facility around the Autodesk / Discrete product line. It's pretty cool there. Quite impressive.
Yep. Yeah. It's a good place to work. It's interesting. There's a lot of people I think who, people make it there. People don't make it there. It's a unique place to work, but the brothers are the most passionate people I know, them growing as much as they have. And, I'm sure they're going to direct another feature soon. And, we've done a ton of commercials as well that the brothers have directed. We did those Mercury commercials with the growing tree, and there was a whole campaign of like 4 spots with that. And
that's what I was going to say. It's kind of good for you guys too, is you get to do a variety of different work. It's you see from feature films to commercials, they each have their strengths and weaknesses when you're working them on the list, But I think it would kind of, I don't know about you, but from my standpoint, I think it would kind of keep me fresh, I guess, doing a bunch of different type of work instead of being pigeonholed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's a different skill set. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's all the same, software tools and stuff and the same types of things, but way of working. I mean, it's a different experience working on a feature film than it is working on a commercial because, commercials can come and go and are usually in the house for no more than what, I would say a long commercial would be a month or two.
Right.
And even that's unusual, I would say.
Right, exactly.
Whereas a feature film, you can be on it for over a year sometimes. And that's a different mindset.
Yeah, it certainly is.
And the pipeline that has to be associated with that and, the order from matte paintings and getting stuff from matte painters and getting stuff from CG. And it's a different experience. It's cool. It's nice to have the variety, like you say.
Yeah, it's a really cool environment to work into. It's pretty, really impressive. Their new digs down there in Santa Monica. Well, relatively new, I guess I should say. So
yeah, it's been a couple of years now, I think, or a year. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, it's been a little while now, but still, yeah, recent.
Well, man, thanks for taking the time here, man, to record this. And
yep, I guess you got to get back to putting together the term for PhD.
Oh yeah, just still getting all the materials ready on the website. Again, we'll be posting on January 1st all the details about the courses. And there's a lot more than what we talked about just in the intro of the podcast. And be sure to check that out beginning on January 1st, at which point you can also register for the new term at the site.
Right.
So,
and what was it? There was like 20 classes last term, right?
Yeah. So we've got people, so. Yes. Yeah. Lots of options for that's one thing that we've done in comparison, or last term that we did in comparison to previous terms, is actually have a lot more repeat courses, especially the introductory level courses. We found that they have a huge demand for those, so kind of expanding the amount that we do. And hey, I just want to mention also, if you haven't seen, I'm sure it's pretty late with the holidays, but if you're woefully behind or you have someone's birthday coming up, we do have gift certificates available at FXPhD if you want to get someone a full-term membership or just get them pay an additional class so they can take an additional course. We have those available. There's a button on the FX guide and FX PhD homepages for information about that.
Hey, employers could give those as gifts to employees as bonuses. That'd be nice.
And it's a write-off.
There you go.
Win-win.
There you go.
Win-win.
All right. Well, thanks, John. Thanks for doing the interview with the brothers and bringing us this information and on the PhD. And we'll talk to you soon.
We'll see you. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.